Good afternoon. So last time we went through some examples of using monitors. We saw applying this pattern where we had this lock protecting a bunch of shared data. We had things we needed to wait for. We made a condition variable for each of them. And despite its name, the condition variable didn't represent like a Boolean value. It represented a list of things waiting for something. And the convention we'd follow is that we have a separate condition variable for each thing you might want to wait for. The things that were waiting, the threads that were waiting, would call condition wait in this while loop, double checking each time if they need to wait. And whenever we changed that condition, we would broadcast, or in some special cases, signal to move things from the list of waiting threads and let them run. We also talked about this alternative to monitors called counting semaphores. So we just use the word semaphore. I said counting because even if you read things, you might hear about other types of semaphores like binary semaphores. So, but our counting semaphores, well, they counted. They could have an integer value that was 0, 1, 2, 3, up to whatever. We had two operations. We had this up or post operation, which incremented that value, and this down or wait operation, which decremented that value. But we didn't allow that value to be negative, so the down or wait operation would wait till it was not zero, and then decrement it, so it would never go below zero. And if we thought of how we would use this, we'd be bookkeeping some sort of count of something, like number of elements in a list, and we choose what number we bookkeeped such that when the count was zero, we need to wait. So for example, you know, if we're going to consume items from a list, we'd keep track of the number of items in the list. When that counts zero, we don't have any items to consume. And that's sort of the intuition we had for using counting semaphores. And we learned that, well, they can do everything that mutexes and condition variables can. We can like use a semaphore that starts at one and goes to zero and goes back to one as a lock. We can do this sort of signal thing where we have one thing wait and one thing post. So they can handle all the functionality of mutexes and condition variables, though perhaps more or less intuitively. So questions on the things we covered last time?
Can I ask a question about
that? Sure. This slide. Yes. Maybe I'll go over some things on the quiz generally, and we'll do the questions on the quiz. So on the quiz, because I edited things at the last moment, which, and had also was trying to deal with conference, question 1C was phrased very poorly, but it seemed like also a significant number of students got it wrong despite understanding what was in the intended phrasing. So I think that's worth talking about. So what we were talking about doing was saying that, oh, you know, rather than having this sort of conditional Marcus lock taken, we'd mark the lock taken as false unconditionally in unlock mutex, and only mark it as taken again in lock mutex. That was the change that I was intending to propose. I know some people had trouble reading it, though I think more people understood what the change was and didn't understand its effects. Or at least a similar number of people. It's hard to guess the numbers from the comments, but I saw both sorts of confusion. So what happens then? Well, if we do this, then, well, regardless of whether we make the change, at this point here, we can have another thread run lock mutex, or the same thread. We can run lock mutex right afterwards and be up here where we're getting the spin lock. And if that happens, this call to lock mutex is going to say if taken, and this is going to be a no, and it's going to mark it as taken equals true, and that's it. So that's something which can happen. And if that happens, that can happen before the scheduler ends up going back to this older thread here that's going to set the lock as taken. And what will happen is effectively two threads will have the lock. So in the question, in the option, I phrased it as, we have two locks return without an intervening unlock, because, you know, conceptually we can think of it as two threads have the lock, but there's not really a meaningful notion of what thread has the lock, right? So I need to phrase that question option carefully to indicate the situation, but effectively two threads have the lock, right? One, we have the lock in the thing that ran lock mutex right afterwards, and the thing that was waiting for a long time and got woken up are going to both get the lock, and we will violate sort of the key property of our locks, which is the only one thing can have them at a time. So that's on question 1C. And also on question 4 and 5, which was the semaphore example, I made a mistake in editing the question, and I included current pair.clear in the blank I removed, because the idea is we form a pair, and then we should make a new pair, and the blank included some of the code to clear the current pair. So there was a correct answer, which was none of the above, and you said do that. A few people got that, but mostly people assumed I wasn't going to do that. So I gave credit for both. And I meant to include this in the supplied code, but sort of the correct answer was we clear the current pair, and then we post twice a make pair. And the idea is we want to allow two threads to go, one to make the first half of a pair, one to make the second half of a pair. And both of these threads are going to be waiting up here. So what they're going to do is the first one's going to go, it's going to acquire the mutex, it's going to push back on the cleared, hopefully, and find out, oh, there's only one thing, as this comment indicates, and it's going to wait for it to be finished. And the other one is going to finish the pair and signal that it's finished, making this stop waiting, and it will proceed with the process. So questions on that? Yes.
It returns twice, though, at the end, right?
This returns twice at the end, so it returns from each call.
Yeah.
So we want it to return in pairs. That is intentional. Yes, back there. The question is, what does that mean for make pairs initial value?
Finish
pairs initial value? Yes, so finish pairs initial value should be zero, as the comment that was on the quiz indicates. Yes. Question, does run scheduler return to this function eventually, or does it ever return? So it will return if the scheduler ever has a reason to switch back. So, and the reason that's going to happen in this case is because we'll be marked as runnable eventually. So if we were never marked as runnable, then it would never return. So for example, the implementation of the xset system call will switch to the scheduler without, in a way where we'll never ever be marked as runnable again. In which case, it wouldn't return. Does that answer your question? So would running scheduler return to the same spot in the execution? That's the intention of the pseudocode. This is like the sketch function. So it runs a switch call. It was XP6. So yes, it would return back to the same place. Yes?
For
So if we put 3 here, then you're right, 3 threads will go here. So the first one will end up here. The second one will end up here and signal finish pair, letting the first one go. And the second one will be stuck on this wait on finish pair.
So if there were like 4 threads instead, like ABCD?
So then if another thread comes along, then I guess it depends what exactly we do here. So if we cleared things here, then, so, well, depends what exactly we do here, but, so, sort of, I guess what, the but before that, I guess, a thing I'd be concerned about is the second thread, right, the one that was woken up by finished pair wait here, it seems like, in your scenario, it's going to get a list of 3 things for its pair, which shouldn't happen. Does that make sense? Or could get it. It's not guaranteed, but it could get a list of 3 things, and that's something we want to definitely avoid.
So I know that odd number of threads still hang, but if it's an even number, shouldn't we have it so that we have, like, the third or...
Yeah, so the question, if we have an even number of threads, we don't want it to hang. So how do we make that happen? And I think the most sensible way to make that happen is to, after we know we're done with a pair, we can let the other threads go. If we don't do that, we have this problem that too many threads are trying to use the current pair vector, even though it's not part of the pair they're trying to make. Does that make sense?
But wouldn't you need to have three for pair initially so that the third thread could get down there?
So the third thread, So in this idea, the way the third thread gets down there is the second thread lets it go. Or rather, the first thread actually lets it go after the second thread lets the first thread go. All right, so the second thread goes here, the first thread resumes, and when it's done, it lets the third thread go here. If we make pair initially three, then we'll allow three threads to go into there, into acquiring that mutex, and we don't have a way of stopping the third thread from pushing back before the second, first and second thread get the values. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah. Sure. So let's. So 1A was asking, asking about the order in which things run. And we're saying that several threads are waiting to lock the mutex. So there's two places they could be waiting. So one place they could be waiting is that they could all be waiting to get this spin lock. But that's actually pretty uncommon. Most of the time, if they're waiting to lock the mutex, because this lock mutex doesn't last for very long, they probably got this spin lock at some point, presumably while whatever thread had the mutex was doing whatever work the mutex is trying to make happen one at a time. And then they added themselves to this wait queue. And if they added themselves to the wait queue, well, which ones become runnable depends on which ones are made runnable by this code. And this code only lets one be runnable at a time. So the scheduler, the only choice it gets to make is, do I run something that needs the mutex now, that can get the mutex now, or do I not run it? Because there's only one thing that's runnable that's going to proceed from lock mutex. Now, it's true that after you make that runnable, something else could try to lock the mutex, but if it does, it's just going to go to sleep. It's not going to let the scheduler let it keep running. Does that answer your question? So the order is determined for the most part by how we remove things from the queue, except for the unusual case where multiple things are waiting on that spin lock, but that shouldn't be very common. Other questions, follow-ups? Yeah.
So the run scheduler, though, is it running the schedule isn't it running the system scheduler?
Question, isn't run scheduler running the system scheduler? Yes. And the system scheduler, if we think of XP6, it's going to switch to a runnable process. For lock mutex, that's not going to be the process that just ran it until something runs unlock mutex. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? So you're asking about blank 2 and 4? Okay, so let's talk about that. Okay, so we had this partial code. It had an error where I forgot to assign TA to a value, but that's irrelevant. So it was asking what goes in blank 2 and blank 4. And blank 4 is while we don't have someone helping us, what do we wait on? So we have to wait for something, and the mechanism we know to wait for things is probably going to be conwait, because we could use semaphores too, but we don't have any semaphores defined. So this is going to be a conwait. And the question is, what are we going to wait on? And we'll need to figure that out. And blank two is when we've set this help by that we're waiting for. So this should be a con signal or broadcast. That corresponds to that wait. So then the question is, what condition variable do we use? And the options we had are that we could use the global condition variable, or we could use the student condition variable, or we could use the TA condition variable, which would be student sort of help by C. So the simplest to eliminate is the TA condition variable, because the problem is that student help by here is null. We can't wait on something with a null pointer. So this just doesn't work because we don't have access to it to wait on. So then we have a choice between the global and the student CV. And well, we do have access to the student CV here, so we could signal it or broadcast it. And we do have access to it here because we have access to the student. And we also can't use the global CV because it's already being used here. So we prefer not to use it for that reason, because we know it's already being used. And in fact, we'll discover that it needs to, it's what we signal when we have a student waiting. So it's what we're going to be waiting on in blank one. And importantly, we signal it, we don't broadcast. So if we try to use that CV for both students and TAs, when we signal, it's going to wake up either a student or a TA, and we won't know which. And that's not what we want to happen. We want to make sure that the signal there that's already in the code that's applied definitely wakes up a TA thread, not a student thread. So in order to ensure that, we better only use that global CV for waiting TAs, which means we have to use the student CV. Why does the TA work? So how do we access it here, right? So TA here is not set yet, and student help by is null. So we just have no way of accessing it because we don't know what the TA is yet. Yes?
So, like, theoretically, even if you don't care about efficiency, like, is it okay to just use broadcast everywhere on the same conditional variable?
Question, if we didn't care about efficiency, could we just use broadcast everywhere in the same condition variable? Yes. So would result in correct behavior if we use global CV here, if that was a con broadcast. It would not be the best solution, because we can do better than that, but it would be correct behavior.
And like, this isn't just
Is the question, is that true in general? Yes. And this is because we're doing this pattern that we always double check the condition when we're waiting. Right. It's just a consequence of that rather than worrying about what conditions changed, we wouldn't affect the correctness if, like, every time we did anything, we just broadcast and woke up all the threads and had them double check their condition. So that's sort of like the worst case, and that would be still be correct, it would just be slow.
Your answer uses broadcast, but signal would have worked
here. The answer used broadcast, but signal would have worked here, yes. Other questions? Anything else? Okay, so I'm going to talk about one other con pattern with synchronization. So we talked about producer-consumer. We learned that was a really common pattern. This is another really common pattern called the reader-writer problem. And we've kind of seen this when I talked about how, like, the vectors work as far as threads go, right? That you can have only one thread modifying it, at least changing its size at a time. But you can have as many threads reading it as you want. And this comes up all the time, that we have data structures where only one thing can modify it at a time safely, but many things can read it. And we can use locks to make things behave correctly in this case. We just acquire a lock before we access the value and unlock afterwards. But that seems a little inefficient if we're doing mostly reading. Right. Because if we're doing mostly reading, there's times where we can have lots of things read at the same time, but locks would prevent that. So there's an extension of locks called reader-writer locks that fix this problem. And we're going to have sort of two types of lock operations. We're going to have a read lock and a write lock. So if you're reading, you use the read lock operation. If you're writing, you use the write lock operation. And read locks are going to allow multiple read locks at once. So unlike normal locks, we're going to be able to have as many read locks as we want at a time, but they aren't going to be allowed to coexist with any write lock. And a write lock is going to act like our normal locks, that if there's a write lock, no one else can use the lock. And so we can sort of express this as a read lock is going to wait and a lock operation until there's no writers, and then it's going to register itself as a reader, and the unlock for the reading is going to unregister as a reader. The write lock is going to wait until there's no readers or writers and register itself as a writer, and the unlock is going to stop being registered as a reader. And these are, as I mentioned, are a really common pattern, kind of like barriers. POSIX has decided that they're common enough that there's a library implementation of them. So POSIX has these RW locks, which implement this. So they have a read lock operation and a write lock operation. There's one unlock operation. So the unlock operation remembers what type of locking you did. So it remembers if you did a read lock or a write lock. And this allows you to have that idea that multiple readers can go at once, but only one writer at a time. So questions on this idea of these reader-writer locks and having multiple readers. Okay, so in that case, here's some code that uses a reader-writer lock. And the putS function just outputs the string specified. So I'm asking, which are possible outputs? I'll give you a minute. And assume we're running all these in parallel. Who would like some more time? Okay, who thinks one is possible? Okay. Two? Three? Four? Five? Okay, so we have consensus that 1 and 3 are possible when 2 and 4 aren't, and a little less consensus on 5. So 1 is just everything, 1, A, then B, then C, then D. So that's fine. 2, well, we have D occurring in the middle of C. So if we think of this code here, like in the middle of this, we have D happening. And that means that we would have to have two threads have a write lock at the same time. But the idea of these write locks is that if you acquire a write lock before writing, only one thing can write at a time. So that shouldn't be allowed. Three, we have two threads getting a read lock at once, but the write locks, nothing else happens in the middle, so that is fine. We can have two threads have a read lock, that's okay. They can. Four doesn't work because we have overlapping threads having the write lock. That's not allowed. You can only have one thing have a write lock at once. So that is disallowed. And five, well, we have the write lock being acquired by C, and in the middle of it, A runs. So I should use probably a different color. So we have A here. So that is happening in the middle of C, which means that we have something has a read lock and a write lock at the same time, and that's not allowed. Read lock means no one else can write. So we don't want you to be reading while someone's modifying something, that's not safe. So 5 is not allowed. Some questions on how I figured that out? Yes. Can I explain three why how B is in between A, why that's okay? That's okay because read locks, we can have as many read locks as you want at a time. So read locks don't actually enforce that other people can't read, they just prevent someone from writing. So we can have 100 threads all get the read lock at once, and they'll execute interleaved while they're doing that, and that's fine. But while they have the read lock, no one can get a write lock. Yes?
So based on that principle, would an output like CCDAADA?
It would output like CC...
BAA...
Or capital E, A, D, capital, which
capital
D?
B after the capital A.
And then?
Lowercase d and uppercase
d. Yeah, that is fine. Because we don't have any, we have overlapping read locks, but no overlapping write locks, that's okay. Other questions? Okay. So,
Can the A, can the lowercase and uppercase end up out of order?
Right? Can the lowercase and uppercase happen out of order? As in, can we have the uppercase A before the lowercase? No, because then we'd be executing this code out of order. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so as I mentioned, POSIX has reader-writer locks, probably implemented using the same sort of facilities they used to implement mutexes, same kind of designs, though we could also do this ourselves with monitors. And it's a good example of how we use monitors. So if we're using monitors, we have a lock to protect our shared state. We have some shared state, and we need to keep some bookkeeping. And we need to keep track of minimally how many readers, how many read locks there are, and whether there's a write lock, which is also how many writers there are. And we have threads that are going to need to wait. So we need our condition variables. Remember, our list of waiting threads. So we have threads that are waiting to read and threads that are waiting to write. Those are our two lists of waiting threads. And we write code for read lock. We're going to get the lock, and we're going to wait until it's safe to read. When is it safe to read? When no one's writing. Notice that we don't care if anyone else is reading. That's fine. So we wait while no one's writing. Well, sorry, while someone's writing, we wait. And for writing, we wait while someone's reading or writing. And if we're waiting while someone's writing, well, when someone stops writing, they need to broadcast to let us know that we can stop waiting. And if we're waiting while someone's reading or writing, when we stop reading or writing, we need to signal to let someone know that they can stop waiting. So we're following our principles of how we use monitors. You know, whenever we change that condition that they're waiting on, we signal or broadcast. So questions on sort of how this code implements our reader-writer logs. That's one way we could implement it, maybe not the most efficient. And how we came up with the while loop conditions. And notice that sort of the key principle, which we'll see again, is that we're just doing this bookkeeping, we're tracking the number of readers and writers. And that's not just so just to make our locks work correctly. So one thing that's maybe a little disappointing about this implementation is that we've decided that we're going to wake up both writers and readers when a writer finishes. And if there's both readers and writers waiting, who's going to get to go? Well, it depends what the scheduler does. Right? We're just going to let them find it out in the scheduling algorithm. And whoever manages to get to their while loop first is going to end up getting to go next. And that's okay, but that's not the most efficient thing. It would be nice to make an explicit decision. And there's sort of two decisions that are the most obvious ones we can make, which is we can either let the writers go first, or a writer go, I should say, or a reader go. But to make that decision, we need to track some more information. We need to know about the number of waiting readers or writers, so we know whether to signal one or the other. But we can track that in the same kind of way we tracked the number of readers, the number of writers. So let's start by looking at implementing this first option that writers go first, that no readers go when a writer is waiting. That's the policy we're going to implement. So if we think of that policy, that's going to change not only when we signal, but it's also going to change sort of when we're waiting. So remember that we always want the thing we're waiting for to match when we broadcast or signal. So we're going to update things accordingly. So this means we're going to track the number of waiting writers, and readers aren't going to go when there's a waiting writer. And that also means we can't signal readers when there's a waiting writer. And we have a choice about which to signal. Otherwise, we don't with this policy. But we have to track the number of waiting writers, and we're going to do that by incrementing the counter when we start waiting, when we enter that loop with conwait, and decrementing it when we're done. Questions? Question, yes. Question, in read unlock while is it if instead of while? So because we have the mutex, the number of readers is not going to change. And we're just going to wake up one writer, because only one writer can make progress, right? If we could broadcast and wake up all the writers, but only one writer can actually make progress. But you might say, what if there's more than one writer? Well, what's going to happen is the first writer is going to go, then it's going to unlock, and then it's going to wake up the next writer. And so that's how that problem is solved, and that's solved without waking up writers that can't actually do anything right away. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. And this idea here of that when we want to make some more intelligent decision, we just do some extra bookkeeping. This comes up a lot if we're thinking about what are my options for implementing some synchronization policy I want. So if we think of how this works, we can sort of give a good idea, we can give a simulation. So here I have my number of writers, my number of readers, and my number of waiting writers. These are literally the variables we have up here. and initially they'll all be zero. And in my example, I have four threads cutting along, three of which want to read, one of which wants to write. So my first thread comes along and wants to read, so it uses a read lock to make sure no one else is writing while it's reading. This read lock is going to check if it needs to wait, finds out it's not, so it's going to go right away. There's no contention. And the same thing's going to happen for our second thread. It's going to check. It's going to find that there's no writers or waiting writers, so we're going to end up having two readers. And then our writer comes along, and our writer is going to check if there's readers or writers, and it's going to find out, oh, there is, so it needs to wait. But before it does so, it's going to increment the number of waiting writers, so we know later on that we have to give way to let this writer actually get to go. If we don't do that, it's basically going to get starved. It's kind of a bad thing about this reader-writer lock design, if we don't handle that situation, is that writers kind of naturally get really low priority just because if you have more readers, you know, you're not going to naturally have a place unless you make it where there are no readers active. That's a reason you might want this writer priority policy. So our read lock reader will come along, and this reader is going to wait. It's going to look at its condition and its while loop, and it's going to say, oh, there are no writers, but there's waiting writers. I can't go yet. And eventually, we'll unlock here. There'll still be one reader. So this unlock won't do any signaling. Then we'll unlock here, and there will be zero readers, so we'll signal that it's okay to write. And our writer will wake up, and it will say, oh, now there's no readers and writers, great. And it will record itself as writing and waiting. This reader here still can't go. We're not going to bother broadcasting to it because it can't go yet. Even though the number of waiting writers changed, the number of writers also changed, so it still needs to wait. So our writer is going to do its modification, and when it finishes, we're going to say, oh, there's no waiting writers, and we're going to finally wake up that reader, which was left to wait behind. Questions about how this implementation of our reader-writer lock works and how it favors writers? So if we wanted, we could also use the same idea to implement the opposite policy. We could say, let's favor readers instead. Let's make writers wait until there's no readers. Let's not, let happenstance, let a writer go ahead of a reader. And we could do that similarly by tracking the number of waiting readers and having corresponding rules for that. And we could implement other policies. So as a little exercise, let's say I want to do an in-between policy. That I want something in between reader and writer priority. So how, and specifically, I want reader priority, which is what I'm starting with here, but I want to have a modification that if writers have waited more than 1 second, that are waiting, I want them to go first. So where should I make modifications to that? Give you a minute to think about that. You can discuss with your neighbors. Okay, so people want more time. Someone can get me started. Tell me some place I would need to change. Something I need to add. Yes, over there. So we need to record how long things are waiting. So we're going to need to add some code to record starting waiting, and probably record finishing waiting, right? Is that what you're saying?
No, I was thinking like just have a variable for the earliest wait times of the write lock.
Okay.
So if the second write lock comes along, they don't update that, they just fall.
Okay, so we went to set earliest write lock sort of time. Write lock time. Okay. So that's something we're going to need. Yeah, we need to do some bookkeeping so we can determine if we're in that condition where things have waited too long. Yeah. So you want read unlock to signal if we've waited for if we've waited for too long. That's what you're saying. So what condition variable do we want to signal? We have okay to read and okay to write. Which one do we want to do?
Okay to write, sorry.
Yeah, so we want writers to go, so it's the okay to write one. So we want to signal that. So we need to change this condition. So you also want to signal it if writers have waited too long. And the way I would think about doing that is that, well, we still need to wait till there's no readers, but we want to change this here if there's no waiting readers. We want this to be or writers waited too long. So that would be one way of doing that. Anything else? Yeah.
You definitely have to change the condition for the while loop for the write lock.
So we have to change the condition in the while loop for the write lock. Yeah, so right now if we signal it, it's not going to go because it's going to say, oh, there's still a waiting reader.
You can have an anti statement and your timer is less than a second.
Okay, so you want to do and timer is less than a second. So the problem, so I like that idea, but we need to also make sure that there's still no other writer and so on. Right? If the timer's less than, if the timer's like 10 seconds, but there's someone writing, we still can't go. So the way I would put it is that probably we want, you know, so this is, and timer is less than a second, or there's a reader or writer, or reader or writer. Okay. So I agree, they need to change there. Other anywhere else? There's one other place I would like to make a change. Yeah. Yes. So say if writers aren't equal to zero, it would be or a writer has waited too long. So if we don't make readers stop going, then writers will never get a chance to go potentially. So that's what we want to fix. And leave. I've done this correctly. The variable, so keeping track of the time, I haven't gone into detail on, but yeah, that would need to be as global as like the waiting reader count. Yes. So the other thing is, you're saying, oh, waiting reader is equal to zero. This should be, or writer waited too long. Yes. And sort of the key principle I would say is that if we think of what this condition here is, right, it needs to match the broadcast, right? The weights need to match the broadcast. And that's why you could tell we need to update that. Is that if you looked at the condition on the read, okay to write, okay to read, they didn't match anymore with what was being waited for, and they always need to match. Yes? So then the question is, don't we have to update the time things have been waiting for as writers finish? Yes, so we need some way of dealing with that, which probably means we need to track multiple waiting times somehow.
Yeah, and I will, for the sake of clean slides, we'll do... So we'll do this, so I have my
clean pseudocode version, which I almost forgot to put in these slides because of Git. Forgetting to Git pull, it happens. So in our remaining time, I'm going to go on to a different topic with threads. So we've gone through reader-writer logs, which are useful in general, and also give us a good example to talk about using monitors. And I'm going to talk a bit about a different problem with synchronization next. Yes? Can I explain the difference between using the and the or? Right. This should be, that should be an or. I'm sorry. This should be an or in the condition here, because we want to wait in either case. Thank you for pointing that out. This is me just doing Boolean logic backwards. Yeah.
So just to clarify, the reader and writer logs don't like guarantee that, or sorry, me having like a reader priority or writer priority doesn't guarantee that like the reading or writing happens first. It's just that like it'll happen first if it gets weeded.
Question: the reader writer priority doesn't guarantee the order of reader writing. It just is what happens when there's contention. Is that what you're asking? Yeah. Okay. So it just says if we have to make a choice, who gets to, what choice do we make?
But like one thread that is reading, even if it's a writer priority, it's like a thread that's reading does this whole thing first.
Yeah, so if a thread has started reading, your question is,
yeah.
And we have a writer priority lock, that thread doesn't stop reading, yes. Because
okay.
The only place where we act on the priority in the lock is on the lock operation. So if we're past the lock operation, priority doesn't take effect. If we wanted to make it take effect, we need to do something a lot more complicated. Okay, so let's... And this should also be true here. Oh, and exclamation point equals right. Okay, I just... do my conditions backwards. Okay. Okay. So let's talk about, and I will fix these errors when I post these slides later today. So let's talk about a different scenario. And let's say we're thinking about coordinating some cars, in this case, on roads, using some principles from synchronization. We have locks. So I want the cars not to collide. So my idea will be that they'll just reserve exclusive access to pieces of road. So we'll just say that if these cars want to move forward, they'll just both reserve the lock piece of road in front of them. Presumably they've already locked the piece of road they're on, and they'll move forward. And if they want to keep going, they'll try to lock the piece of road in front of them, and the black car will find out that, oh, it's already locked by the yellow car, so it can't go. The yellow car will find out it's already locked by the black car, so it can't go. And now we're stuck. And unless we do something other than sort of our try to move forward instructions, we're never going to get out of this situation. And this situation is called deadlock. And I've given sort of a contrived example of it, but this is something which happens a bunch with synchronization with a bunch of different things that aren't like just roads. And let's give an example with pipes, an example we've already kind of seen. So in this case, I have a parent and a child communicating with two pipes. So the child writes to the parent, reads from the parent. The parent writes to the child, reads from the child. And this code hangs. Someone explain, so why does it hang? What's wrong? What happens here? Yeah. So your thing saying is the huge size would make the pipe think it has something in there, and something about reading from it. So I agree there's an issue with reading from it, but when would the reading from it occur here? So here it has to occur after we write. And one of the ways in which pipes work with data is that they buffer some amount of that data in a space managed by the US, but not an infinite amount. And the assumption is that someone's reading from the pipe. So we can just wait until they read. And that's what's going to happen here, is that we're going to have our child. It's going to try to write some data to the pipe. It's going to fill up the storage we have. And we're going to wait for someone to read from the pipe. Because we're assuming that, well, if you're writing to a pipe, someone's going to read from it. So we can just wait for that to happen. And the parent's going to write to a pipe to the child. And it's going to fill up the buffer. And it's going to wait for someone to read from the pipe. And, well, that's not going to happen because that read is waiting for the write to finish. And it turns out that our child process in this write here is waiting for this read to happen, but it can't happen because this write is waiting for this read to happen, which can't happen because of the other write. So they're both effectively waiting on each other. And the way the code is written, there's no way for them to stop waiting because they're never actually going to get to the do the thing which they're waiting for the other to do. And we can represent this in sort of a graph form where I say we have our parent process. It depends on the pipe buffer, which it's waiting for. It's waiting for space on, which is going to be freed up by the child. But that's waiting for first space in the other pipe buffer, which is going to be freed up by the parent. We have this circular dependency that we can't resolve, and things are just going to hang. So I've shown this example with sort of our contrived road scenario and with pipes, but probably the most frequent case where this problem, which is called deadlock, comes up is with locks. So let's look at an example with locks. So here, I have a function to manage directories, and I'm saying I'm going to have our directories be a struct which has a map from strings to directory entries, so file names to directory entries, and it has a lock. The idea is that if I have one thread accessing one directory, another thread should be able to access a different directory, and they should be able to do it at the same time, so I have separate locks. I don't want to have like one big lock for every to access any directory, so I have separate locks for each one. And I have this move operation, which moves a file from one directory to another. And to do that, well, I want to make sure no one's trying to read from the directory while I'm modifying the map. Like they could access like a null pointer in the map or something like that as I'm changing it, or like a freed pointer. So I acquire the locks. And this can get me into trouble with a deadlock if I have, for example, this is not the only possibility, but this situation here, where I'm moving a file from A to B at the same time as I'm moving a file from B to A. And these are different files, so conceptually, these operations are independent. And usually, it will work. Usually, they'll both just happen normally, so like, it will happen that one will happen slightly before the other, there's no problem. We think of a bridge, you know, our cars would, if one car went on the bridge first before the other, we wouldn't have a problem. Or sometimes they won't happen, they'll overlap, but they'll do so in a way where, you know, where thread two just waits for thread one or vice versa. Like we see here, thread 2 just waits to get the locks from thread 1 until thread 1 is done. But where we can get into trouble is when they're close enough. We think of the code. First, we lock the first argument. We get the lock for the first argument. So we lock A in thread 1, B in thread 2. And then thread 1 tries to lock the second argument, which has now been locked by thread 2. And thread 2 tries to lock the first argument, which has now been locked by thread 1. And the reason why we're waiting on this lock is the assumption is that whoever locked the lock is going to unlock it. The problem is that thread 1 is going to be waiting forever for thread 2 to unlock its lock because it's not going to do so until thread 1 unlocks its lock, and vice versa. So the unlock code, well, it's there. It's never going to get to run. So we have this sort of scenario of this circular dependency again. We have thread 1 is waiting to lock directory B, which is locked by thread 2, which is waiting to lock directory A, which is locked by thread 1. We have another circular dependency. And with these innocent operations, which should have worked. And I showed you this with sort of two directories and two threads, but what makes these particularly tricky to deal with is that this is not the only way this could happen. So for example, we could have it happen with three threads where all three of the threads need to be involved. So in this case, let's say I'm moving a file from A to B, and a file from B to C, and a file from C to A all at the same time. We could end up with a deadlock that involves all three of those directories in a circular dependency. And all three of these threads are going to be waiting forever for locks that they can't get. And we won't be able to look at any pair of threads and figure out, you know, why things aren't working. So question about this deadlock scenario? Yeah, okay, so I showed you sort of this example with locks, and this is sort of a thing which you can do by accident. You see that this code, it wasn't contrived. This was a pretty natural way of doing things, and it triggers this deadlock infinite waiting scenario. And it's a particularly annoying bug because it's a system hang that happens very rarely, but it's an actual hang where things never complete and are never unlocked. I showed you that deadlock could like happen with buffers and locks. It can also happen with some other types of resources. So for example, malloc. You know malloc? When it can't allocate memory, it returns an error. Let's say instead of returning an error, we just said we're going to wait. We're going to wait until enough memory is available. That doesn't seem actually unreasonable. And if we implemented that, well, we could have the same sort of deadlock scenario. That we have, say, one thread allocates a megabyte of memory, then allocates another meg, another thread. If we only have 2 meg, what's going to happen? Well, both of these threads are waiting for more memory, and they're not going to get more memory until the other exits, and frees up its memory. So we can get deadlocks with other types of resources if we're waiting for them. And sort of, I could sort of draw a weirder diagram to represent, oh, we have this sort of partition resource, we can still have deadlocks with that. Okay. So I've sort of shown you informally what deadlock is, but we're going to want to deal with it a little more formally, so I'm going to give a definition. So deadlock's a circular waiting for resources. So a resource is just anything a thread needs to do work. As I said, our most common example is acquired multiple locks, but deadlocks are just about any resource. We just have some characteristics we need to satisfy, and we'll have a formal definition in 2 slides. But first, a note to give you a good intuition that deadlock and something else we happen are different. So we talked about starvation earlier. So starvation, seems very similar to deadlock, because starvation means that we have something that doesn't get to run. And deadlock seems like that. But they're rather different, and I would say deadlock is basically worse. So with starvation, we have one thread, or one or more threads, that are making progress, and some threads that are not making progress. With deadlock, everyone who's involved in the deadlock situation doesn't make any progress. Also, starvation has a relatively easy solution. That with starvation, we can fix the problem by taking turns. So if we know starvation has happened, we can just take turns and get out of the starvation situation. Right? Because starvation is just that we could have chosen this low priority thing, but we didn't. So we can just take turns and give that low priority thing time, fix starvation. With deadlock, we're kind of in a worse spot if deadlock has already happened. There are things we can do, but they aren't great, because ultimately we're already in a situation where we're waiting on things, and we have to undo that waiting on things somehow. So let's go through sort of our formal definition, and deadlock has these four requirements, which all must hold. Meaning, if we're thinking about avoiding deadlock, we can look at any one of these, and avoiding any one of them is sufficient to make sure we don't have deadlock. So one thing we need is we need actual mutual exclusion. That we need something where only one thread at a time can have it. If we have some shared resource that, like, there's no exclusivity, we're not going to have deadlock. So if everyone can print to the terminal, well, we're not going to have deadlock because there's no exclusivity now. We need to have this hold and wait property. We need to have one thread have a resource reserved while using another resource. Well, sorry, while acquiring another resource. Remember that it was important that we were waiting for another thread that held a resource we had, or indirectly held a resource we had, right? We had some sort of dependency. If we don't never hold a resource while acquiring another, this won't happen. We need to have no preemption of resources. So we can't have a thread give up the resource for us. We can't steal it from it. The resources are only going to be released by the thread actually making progress. That was sort of a key attribute, right? That with locks, for example, with our like directory locks, when we couldn't get the lock on directory B, that meant we had no choices about what to do. We just had to wait. We couldn't like tell the thread, get rid of your lock. There was no way of doing that. And we need to have the circular dependency. Some questions about these requirements, such as this is our sort of definition of what makes a deadlocked situation. So we need exclusive resources. So if we don't have exclusive resources, there's no problem. So like if we have a shared screen, but everyone can write to it at any time, there's no exclusivity. We need to have hold and wait. So if I only acquire one resource, well, I can't have a deadlock because I'm not holding another resource while acquiring another one. We need to have no preemption, that there's no option other than waiting for me to give up the resource if I have it and you're waiting for it. And we need to have this circular waiting pattern. Okay, so with that definition in mind, here's some example code. Let's say I have this code with a linked list. My list is A, B, C, D, E, asking which of these can deadlock. Give you a minute or two. Yes. What? When I say all the parallel, can we remove all the nodes at once? So I mean that we have that threads have already acquired pointers to B, C, and D. And for example, for scenario B, we have one thread running remove node B and one thread running remove node D. Who would like some more time? A couple people. Okay, who'd like still like some more time? Okay, so who thinks the answer is A, B, C, D, E, F, G? Okay, so we have a plurality for A and C, which I believe is the correct answer. So first, let's talk about why B is not, why the B scenario doesn't cause deadlock. And the easiest way, I think, to see it is that these two operations, the only resource they share is C. And that means that one of them is going to lock C, and the other is going to wait for C. But while that other one locks C, it's not going to be trying to get anything the first thread has. You know, because there's no overlap. So one thread will get A, B, and C. The other thread will get C, D, and E. So it's true that one of them could be holding C while the other's waiting on it. But the one that's waiting is not also holding anything the first thread's interested in. So there isn't any possible circular wait. In the other scenarios, we can have some deadlock scenarios where we have that circular dependency. For example, with B and C, you know, we want to lock C. C, that's already locked by the remove of C. Well, it wants to lock B. So you're going to get that circular dependency. So questions about how I figured that out? So for this? Okay. So let's talk about ways of avoiding deadlock. And the way I would think about it is we went had those criteria for deadlock, and we can just attack them as ways of avoiding it. Yes, question. Question C and D would also deadlock? Yes. Now, for option C, it's sufficient to know that B and C would deadlock. So even though there's more ways for deadlock to happen, it's sufficient to know that since B and C together deadlock, of course, adding something else still means we have a deadlock. Yes?
Can we add like a spin lock or something for those three commands
Can we, so the question is how can we avoid this deadlock? Can we like add a spin lock or something? So let's talk about that, and I have some options here. I'm going to talk about the preferred option, which is not what you're describing, but what you're describing can be an option. So one way we can avoid deadlock is if we just don't have shared resources. If we have infinite resources. So like if we think of the memory scenario, if we just never ran out of memory, we never have a problem with contention on that. If we like gave every thread its own directory, for our move file example, we never have a problem with contention. That's not always possible, but when it is, it's going to solve deadlock. We can also avoid waiting. So the lock operation waits. We could instead have an operation that's more like malloc, which doesn't wait, right? Malloc just fails. And in fact, POSIX has a try-lock operation which does that. You can use, but it's very hard to use. So like it exists. It is a way of avoiding deadlock. I don't think it's a very practical way because it's very hard to use this in a way which isn't very inefficient. But it's out there. You could also imagine having some way of revoking locks, of saying, sorry, you need to stop now. And this is in fact done. So this is a common technique databases uses to solve deadlocks, but it involves a lot of bookkeeping. For databases, that can be worth doing. But for most of your programs you're going to write, probably you aren't going to bother. But we can have something where we say, oh, you're in the middle of accessing this directory that I want to get. Why don't you undo the operation you started and let me use it now? And databases implement that sort of thing sometimes. But for most programs, that's not going to be a worthwhile technique. So the most common technique and the most viable and the one I want you to know is acquire resources in a consistent order. That if we have a consistent ordering, this avoids deadlock. So why does it avoid deadlock? If we think of that graph, we need to have one thing that we acquired, you know, first that's different than what the other thread acquired first, right? In order to have that cycle. If we just both acquire, so we have two threads that both try to acquire A and then B, well, we're not going to have a deadlock because we're not going to get that circle there. We're just going to have no circular dependency. So for example, we could fix our move file function by just choosing an order. Doesn't matter what the order is as long as we're consistent. So here I've just chosen, I'm going to use the path name to decide what order I acquire the locks in. That's going to avoid the problem. Any ordering will do. We just need to make sure it's consistent and we use it every time. And this is what we see most commonly in kernel programming. So for example, the Linux kernel has comments about lock order, saying that in this code, we have a bunch of locks. Here's the order I want we use them in. We always acquire the LDT user semaphore, then the mmap semaphore, then the context lock. In that order every time, so we avoid deadlock. And they just have comments. And they just make sure when they're writing their code, they follow these comments for the order in which they lock and unlock things. So there's another strategy, which I think you were alluding to, which is if we don't have a separate lock operation for each sub-resource, but we can do all the locks in one atomic way, yes, that would also avoid deadlock. Though that's often not practical. Okay, questions about these mechanisms of avoiding deadlock? Yes?
Do we need hardware support for the last option?
So a way we could simulate acquiring all the resources at once is if we like acquired a global lock before doing all our locking together and then released it, right? We can simulate that sort of thing. Or we do this naturally if we only have one lock for all the resources. Right? Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so that's where I'll finish up today. Next time we'll review this a little bit and then talk about virtual memory.